thanks for joining me for this segment of Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and ultimately successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that wonderful moment when you can high-five the person sitting next to you as you say gleefully, "Yes, I'm in." Now, I just finished reading a wonderful book called The Roadside MBA. The authors, three professors now teaching at Stanford GSB, Kellogg, and University of Utah's Eccles School of Business, met when they were all starting their professorial careers at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. They decided to take a road trip and learn how small businesses are implementing economic principles on Main Street. We're going to hear from one of these Charles Kuralts of management in just a second. Before I start my conversation with one of the authors, I also want to remind my ASD listeners of a relatively new feature here. We invite your questions. If you have an admissions-related question, just go to the show notes at info.accepted.com/68, and you will see a widget that will allow you to leave an audio message in which you can ask your question. You can speak using your computer mic or your phone. You can also send me questions via email at questions@accepted.com. If your question is chosen, I'll ask and answer it on the show. Now I'd like to introduce our guest today. Dr. Scott Schaefer holds the Kendall D. Garf Chair in Business Administration and is Professor of Finance at the University of Utah's David Eccles School of Business. He has a PhD in economics from Stanford and is a frequent guest lecturer at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. Dr. Schaefer, welcome to Admission Straight Talk. I'm thrilled you agreed to join us today.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here.
Great. How did you come to write the Roadside MBA?
Let's see. So the three of us are friends, as you said, from way back. And after we kind of all went our separate ways, after we started our careers at Northwestern, we would meet up periodically at conferences. And I don't know if you guys have been to economics conferences very much, but they're pretty boring. And so we were always looking for entertainment at these conferences. And so one thing we started doing is we said, well, you know, let's have dinner together, and let's not just have dinner and then be surrounded by other economists. Let's get out of town.
Yeah.
And so we, one year the conference was in New Orleans, and we drove up to Mississippi and had dinner. And another time the conference was in Washington, D.C., and we drove to West Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And the way we really got started on this project was we were at a conference in Boston and drove up to Maine and had lunch. And then after we had lunch, we had an hour or so to kill before we had to get back on the road to catch our flights. We wandered into a shoe store.
Yeah.
And this was really one of those kind of unexpected, life-changing events that we walked into the shoe store and started talking just on a chance conversation with the sales staff there. And they were complaining a little bit about some of the ways the shoe store was run, the employees were.
Mm-hmm.
And so after a few minutes, all of the employees, including the manager, and all three of us were involved in this long half-hour, 45-minute conversation about how this shoe store was run. And the thing that was so interesting about that for us was that they were talking in plain language about really interesting problems that the shoe store was facing. It was exactly the same kind of stuff that we teach in our MBA programs.
Uh-huh.
So we got back in the car and started driving to back to Boston, and we were just talking about all the great examples of important MBA principles that we saw in this half-hour conversation in a shoe store. And what we found is that we, as professors, we just couldn't stop talking about it. Every time we'd get on the phone with each other, we were talking about, oh, remember the time in Maine when they were talking about blah, blah, blah. I just brought that up in my class, and it was really great because it caused a discussion about this principle, which was really super. And from there, we thought, you know what? We got to get away from the universities, get away from the other economists, get away from the ivory tower. We got to get out on the road. And so we start taking trips just to have more experiences like that one.
It also seems like you decided to get away from the big corporations. I mean, that it wasn't even so much the geographic diversity, it was the size, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know.
Or was that not so much?
No, that was that wasn't well. It was size, but also, you know, business schools focus on the really big companies. So, you know, for your listeners, if they're trying to get into business school, when they go there, they're going to hear about Procter & Gamble, and they're going to hear about Microsoft, and they're going to hear about Apple Computer. And by about the middle of their second year, they're going to be sick and tired of those companies. Other companies that they're going to hear about are startups, mostly, you know, technology startups. They're going to have some, you know, when you go to get an MBA, you're going to have some alumni of the school who just started some Silicon Valley startup thing, whether it's in Silicon Valley or not in Silicon Valley, some technology startup, and he's going to be polished and glitzy, and you're going to hear all about technology startups. Well, there's a lot more to the world than Fortune 500 technology startups.
Right.
And the shoe store that we talked to, not Fortune 500, definitely not a technology startup, but yet the management issues that were there were still really interesting and compelling. And these are good management problems that need to be solved. And they're great illustrations of problems that come up in every business. And so what we tried to do was avoid the Fortune 500. We stayed out of Silicon Valley. And we went and found other companies that still had lots going on.
Like your main shoe store.
That's exactly right.
Now, your book starts off with what your website refers to as the Roadside MBA Manifesto. And that sounds vaguely Marxist, actually. Can you touch on
a little bit,
right? Can you touch on Maslow's law and the two corollaries which underpin the entire book?
Yeah. We think that there's a lot of management thinking out there that understates the complexity of the modern business environment. You know, if you go on the internet and start reading about business, which I'm not sure I really recommend reading about anything on the internet, but if you go on the internet, what you'll find are, you know, five solutions to all your marketing problems, or three steps to fixing your human resource management issues, or, you know, seven ways you can make $1 million tomorrow. Well, you know, the world's not like that. Right. And what we want to encourage people to do is to actually think.
You want people to think?
We actually encourage people to think, yes.
Oh, wow. That is revolutionary.
It's
it may not be Marxist, but it might be revolutionary.
Well, we chose the word manifesto for a reason. So Maslow's law says that the answer to every strategic question is it depends. And the reason we call it Maslow's Law is because Mike Maslow, one of my co-authors, taught business strategy at Kellogg for years and years and years, and he just found that he was repeating "it depends" to his students all the time, and this became a bit of a mantra for Mike. And so, you know, just as an illustration of that, right? So, to take an example from the Fortune 500, you've got if you ask MBA students, and I'm about to start teaching next week, if you ask MBA students on their first day, you say, do you want to, if you're starting a new business, do you want to offer a high-quality product or a low-quality product? And the students will all say, we'll offer a high-quality product. And it turns out that that's not necessarily right. Of course, quality is good, right? An Apple computer offers these very high-quality iPhones and computers and iPads and all that stuff, the very top end of the quality spectrum, and they've made a ton of money.
Right.
But then you think about another company that's made a lot of money, that's made a very different choice, which is Walmart, right? Walmart is incredibly successful, huge company, right? But when you go into Walmart, you know that you're not going there for the quality. The quality is going to be okay. It's not that they're selling total junk, right? Mm-hmm. Quality is what it is. But the reason people go to Walmart is because of price.
That's right.
And Walmart has built their business around low prices, not about highest possible quality. And so is high quality good? Well, it depends, right? It depends on what the consumers value. Walmart has identified this huge market of very price-sensitive customers. And those customers, they like quality, but they don't like it enough to pay more for it, right? And so that's just one illustration of the it depends idea. So the first corollary to Maslow's law is, of course, that the trick is figuring out Well, it depends on.
Right.
This is where you really have to think. This is where the MBA helps, right? This is where the frameworks that we teach in an MBA program are so useful in making managerial decisions. You know, to go back to that quality example, one of the things I'll be teaching in my managerial economics course upcoming is how to think about decisions of increasing your quality or not. When does it pay to move up in the quality distribution?
Right.
And it depends on, as I said before, the consumer's willingness to pay, how large the market is of consumers who are have a high willingness to pay for quality, and also the cost of delivering that quality. And so you've got to be able to think about all those it depends things before you make a decision, right? And if you go on the internet, you can find some list, you can find some successful business person who's going to say, oh, you've always got to be high quality, right? And that just isn't true. You should be high quality when it pays to be high quality, but don't pursue quality simply because you think it's a good thing.
Right.
And I think the second corollary to Maslow's law is just that if the answer isn't depends, then it's not a strategic question. And so there are some business decisions that are simple. Those aren't the hard ones. And what we try to focus on in the book and the problems that really get us going are the problems where it's really hard and there's not an obvious answer. And you've got to think hard about what the right decision is.
Well, those are usually the ones where you have a lot of unknowns. You know.
Absolutely, and figuring out which of those unknowns is likely to be most important, that's tricky.
Right. I know in my work with MBA applicants, my frequent answer is, it depends. And I'm not talking about economic decisions. I'm talking about,
right.
You know, when should you take the GMAT again, and, you know, when is your GPA too low, and all you know, things like that. And the answer is ever so frequently is, well, it depends. It depends what school you're applying to. It depends on your undergraduate institution, you know, all kinds of things. So anyway,
well, I would say that you know, applicants making decisions, you know, those are economic decisions, right? Because those are economic decisions about, you know, what kinds of skills I'm going to get and what kind of business school and what kind of career I'm going to get.
Right.
So it all feeds back into people trying to make good decisions about their careers.
Right, maximizing value on some level, which is,
absolutely.
If I remember my economics, is kind of fundamental there.
That's fundamental business, absolutely.
That's right. What is your favorite story in the book? I mean, there are lots of great stories there.
Oh, boy, it's like asking me what my favorite child is.
Have a favorite flavor of ice cream? I don't know.
Yeah. No, I really like some of the stories. We have a chapter called Battling the Big Boys. And some of the questions there, some of the things that we really learned about on the road had to do with how small businesses are successfully competing with bigger firms. And this is hard, right? Because scale of business brings you a lot of advantages. You have a huge marketing budget. You've got, you know, lots of economies of scale, you know, lots of ways that those bigger companies can have lower costs. But one of the things we found was that smaller companies are good at some things that bigger companies aren't good at. And so big companies, for example, are bad at internal communication. Anybody who's ever worked in a big company, there are rivalries that develop between the various divisions in a big company. People talk about silos inside of large organizations where information that's in one part of the business can't find its way into another part of the business. And so we talked to a really, really interesting company. They're a defense contractor in Pueblo, Colorado, and they've won a couple of contracts going up against some big companies. And the way they've done it is by being better at sharing of information internally. So they told us this great story about a contract they just won. The salesperson was out talking to a customer about some other project, and the customer said, oh, you know, we're having this problem, and we're really trying to fix it, and we can't figure out a way to solve this problem. And so the salesman came back, and this was maybe the best line in the whole book. The president of the company says to us, We only have one water cooler at GPS source, and we think that's an important source of competitive advantage. And what he meant by that was the salesperson came back, and it's a 25-employee company, and he happened to run into an engineer literally at the water cooler, and the engineer said to the salesperson, oh, yeah, we can solve that problem. And a couple of iterations later, they had solved the problem. They went back to the customer and said, hey, you remember that issue you were having? I think we have a solution. Next thing they know, they have an RFP that's put out by a customer that's specifically directed at giving a contract to GPS Source, the small company that we talked to solve this problem. And so here's a case where the customer's need made it into the ears of the engineer in a way that just doesn't happen very easily in big companies. And so that's a fun one for us.
That was a fun one. I remember that very well. There was also one there where I think a sporting goods store owner really took advantage of his local information, his knowledge of the local high school, et cetera. That was another good one. And another one that I liked was the small bookstore that was somehow surviving, in this Amazon world.
Yeah, I think a lot of these things come down to the sporting goods store is a good example. He told the story about the big guys not knowing how to advertise correctly for the local market. So he told the story about, the youth football season in my town starts, August, first week of August every year. And so that's when the kids are looking for football stuff. He told the story about how his big competitors at the malls, they run these big ad campaigns with football gear, but they always run their ad campaigns 2 weeks after football season starts. And so they miss the market.
Of course.
They aren't tailoring the marketing to the local market the way he's able to.
Sure.
And, that's a nice illustration of the disadvantages of scale, right? So a huge sporting goods store is trying to centralize their marketing dollar purchases so they can get good deals on their ad spend, but that limits their ability to tailor marketing for those local markets.
Right.
And this guy, was doing a good job of exploiting this weakness of a bigger company.
Yeah, and I remember that one very clearly. Well, was there a story that you came across that you had to leave out of the book and you really wish you could have fit into it?
There were.
Or is that an unfair question?
A lot like that.
There are a lot, yeah.
We're now writing a column for Inc.com where we're using some of those. Let's see. A couple of stories that ended up off color in some way that we couldn't include, even though they were very good. Some stories that just wouldn't fit in a family oriented
management
book.
You had to keep it G-rated.
Let me see if I can think of a good one like that. Let's see. I'm drawing a little bit of a blank.
We can come back to this.
I presume you can edit this podcast.
Yeah. My editing skills are limited.
Let's see. We heard a great story that our editor didn't want us to include. We wrote it up and everything, but it was about scale economies in radio.
Yeah.
And the editor looked at that and he said, "Oh, come on, radio. What is this? The 1950s? This is a story about a guy.
Radio actually still one of the most used? I mean, radio has not suffered the decline, let's say, television has. At least last I heard about it. I don't know. Because people still turn on... Or is it also suffering like television? I thought it wasn't suffering as much as, let's say, television or movies.
I think...
Theater attendance.
There are recent technologies that have really... The internet radio has really cut into...
Podcasting.
Music on the radio.
Yeah.
And then, in terms of talk radio, I think there's still a lot of that. out there, but you have competitors like podcasts and like satellite radio now that give people a lot more choices.
Right.
But, you know, this story that we heard was about a guy in Missouri, and this happened in the 60s and 70s, and what he did is went around to small radio stations in Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska, and he started to sell them live farm reports. And so these small radio stations didn't have the resources to do a live, you know, every hour farm report. But that was something their listeners demanded.
Uh-huh.
And so the listeners would turn over to the big radio stations from Kansas City or from Omaha or from St. Louis. And so these smaller stations were losing out on a lot of business because they didn't have a dedicated farm reporter to gather all that information. Well, what he did is he said, you know, this is clearly an example of an activity that has big economies of scale associated with it, right?
Right.
For one farm reporter, the cost of producing a report that can be shown at that can be played on two stations is not only different than the cost of producing a report that can be played on one station, right?
Mm-hmm.
The incremental cost of adding a station is
basically
zero.
Syndicating the report.
Right, and so that's exactly what they did. They syndicated this report, and he signed up within a couple of years. He signed up 700 stations, little AM stations at little towns, right? But all those pennies, right, they add up. And so this guy built this into a huge business that that is still doing farm reports for these little radio stations. But it's just this perfect example of economies of scale, where the cost of serving the second one is much smaller than the cost of serving the first one. And if you understand economies of scale, that is really the key to understanding what businesses can grow and what businesses can't, right? I mean, every time this guy signed up another customer, right, his margin increased.
Sure.
Right? His margins doesn't shrink as he adds customers. His margins grow as he adds customers. And that's how you make a business big, is understanding when you can find those cases.
That's fascinating. That's a great story. I think your editor was wrong. You can tell him I said that. I heard a story. I read it, I think, in a book once. This was a long time ago. It also had to do with radio, and it had to do with New England. I don't remember the name of the book, though. It was something about the importance of data and analytics. And the author of the story, what had been as a child, had helped out in his dad's car lot. His dad was at a dealership, and it was, and the dealership was in New Hampshire or Vermont. And one day, a couple of men in suits walks into the dealership and asks his dad, and he's, you know, sweeping out the showroom or something. And it was in the 60s. And he asks, and these two guys in suits are standing out because the typical attire in Vermont and New Hampshire at that time of year is flannel shirts.
Uh-huh.
And they walk in, and they're kind of swaggering and looking down on the locals. And they go to the fellow's father, and they say, you know, are you advertising on the radio? And he says, either he said, yes, we are. He says, well, what about you advertising on our station? And he gives the, you know, call code for the station. And I think this was at a time when there were far fewer stations. And the man says, no, we don't advertise on your station. So he says, well, you know, you really should be. It has so many listeners. It has so many this. You know, it gives all kinds of stats about the listenership of this particular radio station. And the father turns to these two guys and says, you know, you don't know anything about my customer base and my listeners. He says, let me show you something. And he pulls out a paper spreadsheet, you know, the old green column kinds of things. And he says to him, you know, every time a customer of mine brings in their car for repair, I ask my mechanics to jot down the stations they have on the automated buttons.
Yeah.
So I know exactly the stations my customers are listening to, and it ain't yours. Good day, gentlemen.
That's a good story.
That's also local knowledge.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What was the the most surprising takeaway for you and your colleagues from your visits to Main Street?
Let's see. I think there were several. Some of these were surprising, and some of them were just reinforced what we probably already knew but didn't know as well as we do now. So, I mean, one thing that we really found was that the small business people we talked to they were really smart. And I guess we hadn't fully appreciated how much of an intellectual activity running a small business is. Mm-hmm. You know, this is really challenging, and to the people that we talked to, this is really fun work. They loved their businesses, they loved talking about their businesses, and they were really, really thoughtful about it. You know, we deal with, you know, really sharp MBA students all the time, and so many of them go off to be